funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much is too much to expect from a teenage girl? While we all want the best for our daughters, it turns out that demanding the best from them in every aspect of their lives is more likely to harm than help them. My guest today believes that adolescent girls in today's America are under a tremendous amount of stress to succeed, not only in the stereotypically feminine ideals of beauty and charm, but also in athletics and academics, the competitive arenas once reserved exclusively for boys. And not only are girls operating on multiple playing fields, many feel like they have to be perfect at everything. Stephen Hinshaw is chair of the psychology department at the University of California at Berkeley. He explores these dangerous expectations in a new book called The Triple Bind, Saving Our Teenage Girls from Today's Pressures. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Concurrent with the rise of these expectations for girls, you have noted a steep rise in mental illness among girls. What tells you that those two things might be related?
Well, in many ways, it's the best time in history to be a teenage girl, young woman. Look at the opportunities out there. 57% of bachelor's degrees are now going to women. Half of all medical and law school admissions. Athletic scholarships unheard of in my day. So what's the problem? This is the opportunities these girls' mothers and grandmothers fought for. At the same time, however, we have data that are very troubling from the last 10 years showing us that the ages at which females get depressed are dropping precipitously into the teen years, that rates of suicide and cutting, self-mutilation, binge eating are at all-time highs in preteen and teen girls. And even though there's genetic risk for some of these conditions, obviously genes haven't mutated in a decade. There must be something in the environment that's pushing the genetic envelope, driving those girls at highest risk to ever higher rates of serious mental health problems. And so the Triple Bind explores what are the particular kinds of pressures and what's some of the particular toxicity in the environment that may be driving some of these very alarming mental health statistics that are accompanying this time of great opportunity.
And it's interesting, Stephen, because this is not the exact opposite of the outdated assumption that girls as a whole were inferior to boys, because that thinking never required all boys to feel they had to be perfect in every way.
No, girls today receive a set of pressures that certainly everybody's under pressure. Now look at the economic downturn now. People are feeling it. But boys never received this particular kind of pressure. So let me elaborate. Girls are still those whom we socialize to be the nurturers and caregivers in society. And some of that is actually nature, not nurture. Even two-year-olds, if you show them videotapes of someone in distress, girls pay attention more. They seem more empathic than boys. And we raise our daughters to be the next generation of those taking care of families. So there's nothing new there. But now, second, in the last generation or so, we've got to raise our daughters to be very competitive because they're actually outperforming boys in admissions to top schools. They're getting athletic scholarships that they didn't have opportunities to get before. And as we say in the Triple Bind, how do you be best friends forever and at the top of your class? There's a conflict and a bind there. It's hard to be empathic and nurturing at the same time that you're relentlessly competitive. Now, that's not brand new either. For a generation or so, girls have had this competing set of pressures, and boys haven't had those. But the third aspect of the Triple Bind is the newest, and I think the most troublesome. The girls that we have spoken with, girls in my research studies, the scientific literature, all converge on girls are feeling relentless pressure to be perfect in every way, but they have to do it effortlessly. No one can see them sweat. At the same time that media images of model-like sexuality, sexualization, and sexual objectification are turning even the alternative role models, the places you might go if you wanted off the rat race, into size 4 or 2 or 0 or now, I guess, even double zero dresses. And this focus on looking perfect, being perfect competitively and compassionately, puts a kind of pressure on our teenage daughters and creates a sense of, I guess I have to live up to these impossible expectations. I better please everybody. This is a false self, not a true identity. And the real goal of adolescence is to form an identity as to how you want to live your life and who you want to be. So these alarming mental health statistics, and to summarize, by the age of 19 in the United States today, one girl in four, one young woman at age 19 in four, will have experienced a major depression, made a suicide attempt, exhibited cutting or other evidence of self-harmful behavior, or the symptoms of an eating disorder like binge eating. And that's an unacceptably high rate of serious mental health problems that are now going alongside these great opportunities for young women.
So is it that female quality of I suppose, empathy and of the desire to please everybody that is basically the killer here?
Well, let's think about this. I think you raise a good point. We know from research like that I just cited, that even from very early ages, toddlerhood, age two, girls are more empathic than boys. They seem to care more about others' feelings. Walk into any preschool, and you'll note that the girls are more verbal, speaking in complete sentences and paragraphs before the boys, much more socially engaged in small, intimate social groups. So this empathy and these verbal skills and these advanced social skills are really quite protective in the earliest years of life. Girls don't develop autism or ADHD or aggressive conduct problems. These are protective factors for girls. However, once we hit the teen years and the onset of puberty and early adolescence, if a girl has a depressed mother or father, or if she's been maltreated or lives in poverty or has other what we call risk factors, these same qualities of empathy and verbal skills and compliance and social abilities that were so protective for her 10 years before are now actually predictive of depression and anxiety and substance abuse. Some of girls' early protective qualities, just as you pointed out, turn out to be risks for these mental health problems that come online during adolescence. But it's not just that girls are too empathic. That's part of it. They may be too empathic in a culture that demands them to be perfect in every way, so they lose sight of their own aims and goals, relentlessly trying to please others and somehow having neglected to take care of herself.
I was really surprised to read that this is not limited to a sort of subset of upper middle class girls who have parents who are high achievers. This is happening across the board.
Well, and we think about suburban upper middle class kids in general, and girls in particular may have particular risk. We do know that, however, having lower social status, having other markers of poverty, actually increase the risk for just about every mental disorder. The only exception to that might be bipolar disorder, which tends slightly to run in higher social classes. But this idea of the triple bind, that it is a sort of poisonous set of cultural expectations, isn't just for upper middle class teens and teenage girls. It seems to affect everyone. Now, there may be ultra pressure among upper middle class kids to get into the absolute best colleges, but just look at the scholarship set up now for many of the top private schools. It's kids at or near or below the poverty level who have better scholarship opportunities. They have extreme pressure to succeed academically and athletically too. So you're absolutely right. This isn't just for one aspect of a sort of elite society. The risk for these problems, depression, suicide, cutting, eating symptoms, and even aggressive behavior, interpersonal violence, is on the rise among girls today, while it's dropping in boys. And this is happening across all ethnic groups and at all levels of the socioeconomic spectrum.
would you call this an unintended consequence of all the cheerleading we've done for girl power over the last decade or two?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't think it is a consequence of girl power per se. I don't think it's the what we heard some time ago, well, girls and women just want to have it all and you can't have it all. I think it's more a misguided set of cultural expectations. Again, nobody wants to take away. I'm the last who'd want to eliminate the opportunities girls and women have now. There's been struggles for decades to get them in place, and we don't want to take them away. But it's the idea that, and I'll be very concrete here, some of the girls we interviewed for the Triple Bind said things were quite alarming to me. Well, we don't really speak up in our high school classes. What do you mean? You wouldn't speak up in class. You're doing well. You want to show what you know. Yeah, but we get graded down if we don't have the right answer the first time. We lose points on our participation grade. And this took the wind out of my sails. If the idea is you can't struggle to learn, you can't voice an idea, have it shut down and try again, but you got to be perfect first time every time. This isn't the goal of adolescence, of self-discovery. This isn't the goal of forming an identity. This is a kind of misguided expectation that you've got to be perfect. You're never wrong. You're not only perfect academically, but you've got to do your best on the playing field. You've got to look a certain way. There's not enough hours in the day to do this, which cuts down on sleep, which is another aspect of the Triple Bind. Most of our teens are really sleep deprived these days. And it also erodes the sense of, I've got to figure out whom I want to be. I want to figure out what I want to do in my life. No, rather, I've got to pad my resume. A's aren't good enough. It's A pluses and it's advanced placement courses. And not let anybody see me struggle or even wonder about these expectations. It's the relentlessness of this pressure. And I should add, many of the girls we spoke with also said, even though all the media out there and the internet is wonderful in many ways, you can never shut it off. MySpace and Facebook, the email chains of what was said in class that now get magnified and multiplied, the relentless images in the media of how girls and young women are supposed to look, it's almost a vortex of unrelenting pressure that, again, I think it's our cultural expectations have gone awry, and the sexualization of girls continues at a rapid pace that takes away not only from their identity, but it takes away from their cognitive resources. If you're continually gazing into a mirror to see how you're doing and how you're looking, you probably lose sight of the bigger picture, and you can't really focus on the task at hand.
And one thing they're doing when they're online is not only sort of monitoring their own image and their own brand, if you want to call it that, but they're keeping track of everybody else in their circle.
That's right, and girls are particularly good at this. Again, they have a stronger social sense and make more intimate social connections even during the preschool years than boys do. And I started to notice this some years ago when I've conducted summer programs, both for treatment and research purposes for many years, for kids with learning and attentional problems and control groups built right in. When we started running programs for girls in particular, we didn't know what hit us. I mean, the boys, well, there's some misbehavior and you've got to set clear limits and set a time out. And with girls, there was so much more of what today is called relational aggression, getting even, ruining the reputation of, using intense verbal skills to more subtly tear someone else down. And girls are very tuned in socially.
Stephen Hinshaw is my guest. We'll take a quick break and return to our discussion about his new book, The Triple Bind, Saving Our Teenage Girls from Today's Pressures. You can join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Thank you. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephen Hinshaw. He is professor and chair of psychology at UC Berkeley. His new book is called The Triple Bind, Saving Our Teenage Girls from Today's Pressures. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I want to go back, Stephen, to something that you mentioned just briefly at the top of the interview, and that is the impact that the triple bind has on girls' relationships to their peers, because it seems exceptionally hard to be that competitive with each other and still provide any substantive amount of friendship and support to each other.
Well, I think you hit it on the head. This is a tough bind. These are the first two prongs of the triple bind. So if I'm really going to be at the top of the class, if you will, and there's a hierarchy out there, how am I going to support others who are having emotional problems or help others with their academic work? Maybe they would do better than I would. Now, this is tough for everybody, but for a girl and young woman who's been taught since before she can remember that she's got to be the nurturer and caregiver and quite empathic, but who's also sensing from the media and those around her that she can really do better than boys and is smarter than a lot of boys, that's a tough bind to be in right there. And so, but I still got to be nurturing, and I'm still sort of prone to have a social network. And I think part of this leads to what we discussed right before the break, what we call relational aggression or some of this social aggression. You're being connected with other girls, yet you might have to assert your place in the hierarchy, and so your verbal skills and your subtle put-downs, we know that girls are pretty good at doing this. But in the last 10 years, as if we move from social aggression to actual physical aggression, boys since the 1990s have actually dropped in their rates of aggression and delinquency, but girls' rates are up over 30%. Probably because of many factors, but including Title IX. Girls now are at parity with boys for opportunities for athletic endeavors all through school. Girls are learning from ever earlier ages to use their bodies physically. With all the media out there and the YouTubes of girl fights, et cetera, and girls actually asserting themselves and fighting back if they're getting sexually preyed upon, girls not only are compromising their peer relationships through these verbal, more subtle means of relational aggression, but physical aggression is on the rise in girls too recently. So it's a complicated picture.
And are those less robust friendships with other girls also a factor in driving young girls into sexual relationships sooner than they might have otherwise?
Well, you raise a really interesting topic here. Let's just sort of take a step back, if we might, and just look at adolescence. Well, how do we define when adolescence starts? It's usually thought of as the time that our bodies mature into our physically adult forms, the onset of puberty for girls, the start of menstrual periods. In 1900, the average age at which girls started their periods was about 14 and a half years of age. Today, the average is just a shade over 12. So in a century, that's 2.5 years earlier, not again because girls' genes have changed in the last 100 years, but probably because of dietary changes, maybe other factors in the environment. So girls' bodies are readier to be adult bodies at ever earlier stages. Boys lag a year behind, although they're still a couple of years earlier than a century ago, too. So your body's changing, hormones are surging. Those very hormones don't just make for sexual changes in the body in the periphery, but circulate back into the brain. Those same hormones switch on genes that might make somebody vulnerable to mental illness even more vulnerable. So you've got this long period of time to, in middle school, wonder how you relate to other girls, wonder how you relate to boys, figure out these intense social relationships and social structures out there. At the same time, you've got to relentlessly please everyone and look in a very sexualized kind of fashion, those pressures are coming just at the time when bodies and brains are changing. It's confusing, and it makes negotiating the social turf, if you will, really difficult.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Stephen Hinshaw is my guest. His new book is called The Triple Bind. Let's go to Scott in Plano. Hello, Scott.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your show.
Thank you.
Mr. Hinshaw, I had a quick question for you. Now, your book and your research is obviously aimed at girls, and I was wondering in your thoughts as far as if they might be symptoms of a larger social schizophrenia or social post-traumatic stress disorder, like the pressures that we see on returning soldiers, on these workers that go crazy when they lose their jobs, are the people symptoms of a larger societal problem rather than a problem that the girls have to navigate, I guess I should say. And
I'll take my answer
off the air.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. And let me try to provide a little context for it. In the history of American psychology and psychiatry, we've gone back and forth over the last couple of hundred years. Are mental problems really a product of biology? And now with our knowledge of genes, are they inside us? Or are they a problem of social forces and contexts and environments? And we often hear still nature versus nurture. Well, the short answer is today, with our more sophisticated knowledge, that's a false dichotomy. It's nature and nurture working together. Serious forms of mental illness clearly have genetic risk factors. We know that certain mental disorders, schizophrenia, depression, bipolar disorder, ADHD, tend to cluster in certain biological families and biological relationships. But A, there's no single gene for any of those disorders, and B, the genetic risk is exacerbated and amplified by environmental stress. So those at the highest risk for depression have certain genetic configurations that relate to serotonin levels in the brain, but those genes only get activated if a person in their teen years and early 20s has had a lot of negative events and loss. It's not just the genes, it's not just the environment, it's the combination of the two. Now, at the same time, what do we know? Let's look back 75 years. When the Great Depression occurred, not only in the U.S. and worldwide, suicide rates went up, all sorts of stress reactions went up. Look at our current economic downturn. We're going to see similar problems across society. Environments matter. But not everybody's going to be equally affected. Those with early life experiences or even prenatal experiences or genetic risk are going to be those who are most vulnerable to the changing environment. So the short answer to this very provocative question that I started to give a long answer to is genes and biology matter, environments matter, and it's the combinations of the two that really matter that shape the risk for mental illness.
We're talking also here about a generation of young women who have had very little unscheduled free time to sort of just sit around and ruminate. Can you talk about how that plays into this problem?
I'm really glad you asked. There's articles and books out there with the hypothesis that the real problem here is overscheduling. The overscheduled child, the overscheduled teen, these are the ones at risk for these problems we're talking about. Now, if you look carefully, I think we need to take a hard look. All the research, really good studies recently, show that it's not scheduling per se. In fact, except maybe at the extremes, a child who simply doesn't have a waking minute unscheduled, scheduling is probably a good thing. It protects against early signs of drug abuse, promotes better grades. So it's not a bad idea to have kids in activity. But I think there's a difference between scheduling and overpressure. The kids we talk to, the girls in particular for the Triple Bind, said, I'm busy, that's okay, but I have to be perfect at everything. I can't do two or three sports anymore. I've got to do one sport all year because I've got to be perfect at it to get to the state tournament or to make the finals. I can't let down for a minute because if my grade point drops below a certain amount, I'll never get into the top college. So it's not the idea of there's a lot to learn out there and we've got busy schedules. It's the pressure to relentlessly be perfect, to never have any opportunity to be wrong or take a stab in a direction that you're not sure of, to always have this right answer. And I think you hit it a minute ago, Chris. You've got to have downtime, too. You've got to wonder. You've got to take walks. You can't be on all the time. We need time for sleep. We know that, not only to help form our memories, but to help regulate our emotions. And during the day, we need time away from this pressure to really figure out our priorities. And this intense pressure is really taking away that valuable time. I think in many ways, robbing kids of this long period of adolescence and the identities they really could form.
Let's speak next to Katie in Dallas. Hello, Katie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wonder if the speaker could make a comment about or at least compare the United States and other modernized countries, which have sort of inundated access to media, television, magazines, photos of supermodels, things like that, and compare how women in modern countries feel and psychologically what goes on versus young women in countries, maybe like Polynesian countries or countries which don't have so much access to media, maybe third world countries. Did those women, did those young girls suffer the same sort of consequences that girls with, that are shattered by media influences, do they suffer the same?
Well, I really appreciate this question, and it's a complicated one. The triple bind doesn't get into every single cross-national or cultural comparison. Maybe the daughter of the triple bind book will take that up. It focuses a lot on the United States. But you mentioned provocatively in your question Polynesian culture. So really now famous piece of anthropological research was published some years ago, and it examined in certain Polynesian islands, Fiji in particular, what the prevalence of classic eating disorders, anorexia, self-starvation, bulimia, binging and purging, and there was essentially, the anthropologists found out, none of these, what we see way too much in the U.S., these eating disorder problems and syndromes in teenage girls, until, and I don't know the precise year, but at some point in the last couple of decades, television got introduced to this society. Within a matter of months and a short number of years, with the exposure to models, rock videos, all the media images that one would see on television of earlier and earlier sexualization, eating disorders started to emerge in the culture. So clearly what you see has a big influence here. To me, what's fascinating is that the societies in which these eating problems of anorexia and bulimia have a high prevalence and are problems are societies where the main eating problem is overeating and obesity, where there's an abundance of food. In cultures where there are starvation or semi-starvation diets and there's not enough calories to go around, the cultural ideal is more curvaceous and voluptuous, so that having access to food is really a good thing. Again, over here in our nation and in many Western European nations where there's a plethora of food, the ideal is to be much thinner than the heavier, lower social class ideal. So it's interesting that it's not just that there are biologically based eating problems, there may well be, but what the cultural norm is may depend on how many calories are available in that culture. We do know that some of these adolescent female problems are not just restricted to the U.S., don't have enough data to know if the increases we're seeing in depression, suicide, cutting, and binging in the U.S. are being paralleled in time in other nations. But my guess is that as the internet culture spreads further and further, as the relentlessness of the media images spread, we'll see with a kind of time lag some of these similar problems coming online fast and furious in other nations too.
Stephen, do we know whether the girls, those rare individuals who appear to be firing on all cylinders and face this pressure but seem to achieve what they're expected to by society, are they any happier than their peers?
Well, boy, that's a good question about how happy people are. And I think that it's not just a matter of on the surface, are you happy and satisfied? But at a deeper level, do you have a sense of purpose? Are you doing this, if you will, for some other purpose than just pleasing somebody else or looking a certain way? And we may get happy in our materialistic culture by purchasing things or showing the trappings of success, but research on affective science or emotion science tells us that such happiness is really short-lived. We revert back to our baseline pretty darn quick. One of the potential solutions to the triple bind may well be, how do we foster beyond this relentless gazing into the mirror that's kind of at the root of the triple bind, how do we foster a sense of involvement in community, deeper purpose than just ourselves or our looks, and a deeper sense of involvement in the community? I think that may not, when you're forced with those issues, you may not be very happy. There's a lot to be dissatisfied with, a lot of change to be made. But at a deeper level, you've got something you're really mustering your energy for. And I think that deeper sense of purpose and commitment may be the real ultimate antidote to the triple bind.
Stephen Hinshaw is my guest. He's chair of psychology at UC Berkeley. His new book is called The Triple Bind, Saving Our Teenage Girls from Today's Pressures. You can join us via email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Stephen Hinshaw about his new book, The Triple Bind, Saving Our Teenage Girls from Today's Pressures. I want to pick up on what you were talking about just before the break, Stephen, because you have found some remarkable results in girls who were encouraged to pursue volunteer activities, provided it was something that they themselves were really passionate about.
Right. So it's not just, well, let's see, how many extracurriculars can I put on my resume so the college admissions officers will be pleased? We're talking rather about getting involved because of a deep sense of commitment. And a good example in the book, and one of the girls mentioned by name, some of the girls in the book are composites of several girls put together, and this is Lily Gordon, a 15-year-old living right here in Berkeley, who, as a preschooler, had a lot of energy, way too much energy. The parents were very worried about attentional problems and other mental health risks. And in her late childhood, just before she became an adolescent, she noticed some other girls at the middle school doing some fundraising, said as a sort of challenge to herself, well, maybe I can do a better job, saw that one of the causes was really ravaged villages in Africa, AIDS-ravaged and poverty-ravaged villages, made her first trip over at age 11, has gone back every summer, literally is building buildings and hospitals and schools and waiting areas, does fundraising during the year, and this sense of wider purpose and commitment has allowed her to handle all of the female pressures that are talked about in the triple bind and we've discussed on the program with a bit more perspective, with a sense that there's a bigger world out there, and makes her in some ways immune to, do I have to please everybody at every moment, and who am I really? She knows that she's part of a larger community and larger world, and that sense of purpose is really a protection against many of the mental health problems we're talking about.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to David in Flower Mound. Hi, David.
Hi, Chris. How are you today?
Great, thank you.
Wonderful. Professor, and thank you for taking my call. I really love the show. I happen to be a school psychologist here in the area, and a lot of what I see in my practice anecdotally matches a lot of what I've heard on the program today. I'm curious, though, one of the things that I was wondering in listening to the show, what would you say, or was there anything that you detected in your studies to see the role of what the family structure would have on some of these young ladies? Specifically, I'm curious as to whether or not you saw any differences in single-parent families or the impact that the mother had on the role modeling for the young ladies, or what the role the father had in the families. And thank you very much for taking my call. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks.
I really like the question because everything really is related to everything else. The Triple Bind is not a book that says, well, this is just lousy parenting. I mean, back in the 1950s and 60s, we sort of had the view that most mental health problems were a function of inadequate or poor parenting, and it's far more complicated than that. My view is that parents are victims of the triple bind, too. They want the best for their kids. Certainly in today's climate, even more than a year ago when we finished writing the triple bind, things are intense economically. How do I push my kid to be the best he or she can be? How do I help negotiate what I'm sort of losing my sense of being a parent because more and more time from about age 7 onward is spent in school and with the peer group. So parents are in this too. What we know from a lot of research is that when parents are stressed, when they can't devote, obviously parents have to work and divide their energy too, but when they can't devote enough time to really seeing their kids for who they are, when they start to value their kids for their accomplishments and achievements rather than from the real people they are underneath, when they maybe are acting out some of their own unresolved needs or their own concerns about body appearance, their own marital stresses, kids pick up on the underlying messages, kids pick up on the stress and tension. What can parents do is a question that gets asked a lot today. And certainly parents need to recognize if their teens are having serious mental health problems and need to get kids involved in treatment. I grew up in a family with very serious mental illness. My dad was gone for periods of time. What I didn't know is that he was in mental hospitals. He was a philosopher, a really wonderful dad, but had and misdiagnosed bipolar illness and was told by the doctors, never tell your children about this. So my sister and I grew up in silence. If we keep silent about mental health problems, no one's going to be helped. We have to overcome the shame and stigma. And over and above that, I think parents need to do things, and this is sort of in the popular lore, but it's also true and backed by research, have meal times and dinner times together with your kids and family. That is a protective factor. What do you discuss? You discuss what happened during the day. You discuss real things and real emotions. Maybe teach your kids some critical thinking or media literacy skills. Was that an advertisement or a news story? Do all girls have to look like that? Do all women have to look like that? Real talk about real feelings and real issues, this is what connects families. Even in those years, I think it's somewhere between 11 and 13, when no child wants to be caught dead with their parents and do anything to avoid being seen in public with them. But kids are still begging for commitment and attention. And being valued for who they really are, not just their achievements. So these are the kinds of things that I think all parents and families and relatives and neighbors can do. Let's connect with our kids in a real way, certainly push them to do well. I'm not saying that's not a good thing. But if we're only valuing kids for their achievements and what is on the surface, that's only going to fuel the triple bind.
We have an email here from Heather who asks, as a parent who struggles with perfectionism, what can I do to accept my daughters as they are and not pass on this expectation of perfection? And what do I need to do to allow them to make and learn from their own mistakes and still feel good about themselves?
Boy, what a great email. And the first step for many problems is some self-recognition. And obviously this emailer has some real awareness of her own perfectionistic tendencies. And recognizing them is good, working on some of your own issues psychologically or through support to kind of challenge your own, do I need to be relentlessly perfect? Because kids often do what, they see what we do, not what we say. And also, again, this isn't about, gee, let's forego expectations and have kids do their own thing. That kind of permissive parenting isn't a very good way to do it. But it's about finding space in your own life to breathe and think what's of real value and allowing your kids to do that, too, with families and alone, without the constant drive for what's next, what goes on the resume, I'm only valuing you for the grades you get. That's providing a message of, you've got to live up to a false self. You've got to live up to a set of expectations that aren't based in the reality of human contact and human need and wider sense of purpose. So I think this email caller, if you will, is on to something important. We as adults and parents have to recognize some of our own limitations, look and see what we're modeling for our kids, and if we can change some of our own MOs, maybe our kids will change too.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Denton and speak with Joshua. Hey, Joshua.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
My question for your guest today is, I certainly have seen what he's talking about with the culture of kids having a lot of stress put on them and for them to be perfect and to perform a certain way and look a certain way. But I've also seen the other end of the spectrum where there seems to be a kind of culture of apathy among kids, and to the point where it's almost cool or accepted to not care and to not do well and to not be involved in things. And I was just wondering if you thought that if that would be a reaction to all the pressure that's put on kids today, if it's something else entirely.
Boy, a very interesting observation, and it made me think of some of Newton's laws of physics. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, and I think you're onto something here. If the standard is go, 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 never rest, never sleep, and for a teenage girl in particular, and look relentlessly hot as you're doing it and don't let anybody see you sweat, how do you get off that bandwagon? Well, one of the problems in the triple bind is that some of the cultural alternatives we've had in the last 50 years, stereotypically being a beatnik in the 50s and a hippie in the 60s and who knows what in the 70s and all the way to alternative identities, a goth look and identity in the 90s, many of those cultural alternatives have really been co-opted. Even our top female athletes today, our top women's tennis players, our fashion designers or models, our Indy 500 race car driver Danica Patrick poses in Playboy. So you can't just be good in sports. You've got to look like a model, look hot at the same time. Maybe one way, if the cultural role models and alternatives have all been co-opted, maybe the one way off the treadmill altogether is just to say, screw this, I'm not trying at all. The way to be cool or the way to forego the pressure is to just not give a hoot about much of anything anybody tells me to do. There's always, in modern culture, I think, been some problems with, in very industrialized societies, apathy and running up against all the anxieties and pressures. But I think we may be seeing more of that today as almost a complete and opposite reaction to these intense pressures of the triple bind. So I think you're really onto something there.
If we don't get a handle on this problem that our girls are having, is it only a matter of time, Stephen, before the pendulum swings back the other direction or somehow swings around and brings boys into this level of stress?
Well, it's a provocative question. Many social issues and problems don't go in linear fashion. They tend to cycle back. We have eras of reform and retrenchment. We have eras where certain drugs are abused, and then a few years later, others, and it swings back. Boys are part of the mix, too, here. Boys are seeing the images in the media about how sexualized girls need to be. Boys are physically maturing earlier, too. Boys are treating girls like objects, which are causing girls to both internalize and externalize. There's also been a lot of books written recently about boys. Well, they're slower and clunkier and not as sharp as girls. They're the ones we need to have all-boys schools for, so they're not having to compete against girls. We've lost a sense of boys' identity. I don't think that boys receive the same toxic cultural expectations that girls do from the triple bind, but I think it's going to take some of these efforts as parents, as teachers, as neighbors, to change some of the cultural messages out there, not only for teenage girls who are the subject of the triple bind, but also because boys are going to get more and more of this, it's only there to please others, what's your true identity and role. So the triple bind isn't just about teenage girls, it's about all of our kids. So I think you're absolutely right.
When I think about the problems of the triple bind, they strike me as very similar to the issues that a lot of women, maybe of my generation, were faced with suddenly when they got to their 20s and 30s. Does shielding a girl from these pressures now actually put her in a stronger position to cope with them if they inevitably come to her anyway?
Well, right. Maybe one solution for the triple bind is move your teenage daughter immediately to the nearest desert cave. Make sure there's no wireless access, no media images, and obviously, the current media out there are a source of great opportunity for learning as well as the source of some toxic messages. So that wouldn't be my preferred strategy. I think it's not so much absolutely shielding and protecting from all the images out there. That would be almost impossible to do. But providing, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, some training in critical thinking and media literacy and actively questioning what's out there. Kids, as they mature, are going to have to deal with our current culture, like it or not. Maybe less shielding and more providing some coping strategies, reality checks, may be the best way for protecting against the triple bind.
Stephen Hinshaw is chair of the psychology department at the University of California at Berkeley. His new book is called The Triple Bind, Saving Our Teenage Girls from Today's Pressures. Stephen, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
I've been delighted to be on, and thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.